Please be seated. Bo, you want to invite security back in? The second case for oral argument this morning is Alfredo Vargas, appellant versus the state of South Dakota. Appellee for Mr. Vargas, we have Ms. Jamie Patterson, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Caroline Sirska, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Kern has disqualified herself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Michelle Palmer Percy, a circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Kern's place. With that, Ms. Patterson, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. It is a privilege to stand before your honors and argue and speak about the case for my client, Alfredo Vargas, and also to discuss a case that I believe is one of first impression here in the state of South Dakota. The facts in this case are unique, so I would like to start with them. This is a case of an attempted homicide, specifically fetal homicide. The state's theory in this case was that my client, Alfredo, was with a woman who I will call girlfriend, and he had a baby with her. She became pregnant with his baby and let him know that. He did not want that baby, so over the course of approximately 4 months, the state's theory is he put herbal substances into a handful of her drinks. So in this case, the state's murder weapons are herbal substances. And the herbal substances in question are pennyroyal and black cohosh. Black cohosh is not to be confused with blue cohosh. They are distinct cohoshes. At any rate, Your Honors, both pennyroyal and black and blue cohosh can be found in supermarkets across America, in particular the natural food stores or the herbal stores. They are accessible to the public. It is undisputed, Your Honors, in this case that both mother and child were not harmed. The fetus that was born, became the child, baby, was born healthy, and that's undisputed. And mother, girlfriend, was not harmed in any way. During the trial, she testified that indeed she didn't even experience any discomfort when she drank these drinks she said my client gave her. What concerned her was that these drinks tasted minty, and that some of them, and again we're talking about a handful of drinks over approximately 4 months, had a bitter taste to it, or in one cup she believes that she saw a white residue. So out of this concern of these minty drinks, she turned them over to the Rapid City Police Department, two of them, one on May 15th, and one on May 23rd. These two cups were seized into evidence, and what's important to note is that the alleged murder weapons in this case are not in evidence. There is no evidence of pennyroyal in this case seized, nor is there any evidence of any of the cohoshes seized in this case. These two cups were sent for testing and were done by two experts who the trial court qualified as experts, and they were state's experts. Richard Wold from the Rapid City Police Department was the first person to test the two cups, and his conclusions were drastically different than the second of the state's experts, Roger Matheson from Pierre, in the state health lab. The May 15th cup, which was put in a large can, Richard Wold found nothing in the liquid. And in the the May 23rd can, he found terpene hydrate, which is a discontinued cough suppressant. When Matheson took the cans with the liquid in it, Matheson found a trace amount or a minuscule amount of Pulagon in the May 15th cup, which was in the large can, and nothing in the May 23rd cup in the small can. So in essence, Wold found nothing on May 15th. Matheson found Pulagon. Wold found terpene hydrate on the May 23rd, and Matheson found nothing. So drastically different results using the same analysis. And that, I think, is a significant fact that needs to be noted. The other undisputed fact in this case that I do want to note, which is also important, is that the liquid in question, which has since evaporated, and the cans are rusty, the liquid itself was never tested to determine what the liquid was. And that's a key missing fact in this case, because the state's own experts conceded it was possible, because they didn't test the liquid, which they could have easily done, that Pulagon could have been infused or part of that liquid. And because they didn't test to know what the liquid was, everyone keeps calling it soda, but it was actually never determined to determine whether it was soda, and the state's experts said it actually could have easily been done to do that, and they didn't do that. What is Pulagon? Pulagon is an essential oil in mints. Pulagon is not something that the Food and Drug Administration is concerned about. Pulagon can be found in our cupboards across America, in our Christmas cookies, in our toothpaste.
Well, you're arguing facts, and you already did that to the jury, and we're not a jury. So are you arguing sufficiency of the facts, or that wasn't your first argument?
No, Your Honor.
That was your last argument.
No.
So what's your legal argument?
Thank you, Justice Stevenson. The most important legal argument is fetal homicide, is attempted fetal homicide legally possible? And we submit that it is not. State v. Lyerla held that attempted second-degree murder is a legal impossibility. And why is that? Because the only homicide which allows an attempt is attempted first-degree murder. Because in that case, the mens rea is the specific intent to kill. And so because depraved mind is not the specific intent to kill, Lyerla held that attempted second-degree murder is a legal impossibility. And that is what we find here, Your Honors. The statute of fetal homicide under subsection 1 and what was instructed to the jury was that the jury could convict Alfredo upon a finding of an intent to cause serious bodily injury to either the mother or the fetus. Under Lyerla, that is legally impossible. And the case most controlling, I believe, Your Honors, on this point is this court's holding in State v. Rosales, which I did not cite in appellant's brief because it was just decided recently. But in State v. Rosales, this court held that when a jury is instructed on a mens rea that can sustain a conviction for the crime charge, and also instructed a mens rea in the disjunctive in an or, which cannot sustain a conviction for the charge, that is reversible. And that's what occurred in this case. The Vargas jury was instructed that they could convict Alfredo if they found he either intended to kill the mother or baby, or if he intended to cause serious bodily injury to them. And that's legally impossible.
But if he intended to kill the baby, it would be an offense.
If that was only what the jury had been instructed, yes, an attempted fetal homicide would have been permissible.
So the offense isn't a nullity in all respects. If it was pled correctly and instructed correctly, there would be such an offense.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, yes. But as was instructed in this case, because of the or intent to commit serious bodily injury, it became a legal impossibility and requires reversal. However, Your Honors, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Because to your question of the intent, Your Honor, I apologize. I agree with you on that point. However, fetal homicide, the statute, is under a plain reading, an attempt to it is legally impossible. And why is that? Because of the plain language in it. And caused the death is in the fetal homicide statute. And caused the death. Therefore, a necessary predicate fact to the fetal homicide statute is that a death occurred.
But you have to read it together with the attempt statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The state tried to make that argument. However, what was instructed was attempted to cause the death, and that changes the plain language of the statute. And this court has held in case after case after case, 101, that in statutory construction, words are to be given their plain and ordinary meaning. None. This court talked, I think, very well about statutory construction in the decision of Wiersma versus Maple Leaf. And it talked a lot about statutory construction. But I want to point out one sentence in particular. This court said, we presume the legislature never intends to use surplusage in its enactments.
Well, under that rationale, there could never be an attempt at anything.
No, Your Honor, that I disagree respectfully. If you look at the other homicide statutes, the definition of homicide necessitates that a killing occurs, or else we wouldn't have a homicide. But the other statutes don't have and cause the death. And cause the death means just that, the death occurred. And if you don't give it its plain meaning, then it becomes unnecessary surplusage. It makes no sense because, as argued in appellant's brief, you take out that phrase, you can still successfully prosecute a fetal homicide statute without and cause the death. And I think what is important to note is the discussion in the footnotes in both the majority and the dissenting opinion in Maple Leaf. Because in both the majority footnote of 3 and in the dissenting opinion in footnote 1, this court talked about the difference between fetal homicide and fetal assault. And in footnote 1 of Anderson's dissent, he discusses that the plain language in fetal assaults require that the fetus be born alive. And because the legislator specifically added the fetal homicide statute in 1995, as well as added the unborn child to all the other homicide statutes, it shows the legislator's clear intent, which was that for a fetal homicide prosecution, you have to have a death. I believe I will discuss that more on rebuttal. But I would also like to talk about the errors that occurred in this trial if this court finds that attempted fetal homicide is not a legal impossibility. I'll start with the secretly recorded phone call. 1 week before trial court permitted the state to play a secretly recorded phone call between my client Alfredo and his wife, who was not the girlfriend, so I'm calling her wife. This was despite the fact that at a prior hearing, the state had conceded that communication was protected by the spousal privilege communication and could not come in. However, 1 week before trial, they asked for it to come in the state. The trial court permitted it under a few theories. The first theory was that the spousal communication privilege was waived because of consent by the wife. That is a clearly erroneous finding. You only need to analogize it with other areas of analysis and privilege. For instance, attorney-client privilege. If my client calls me up with the expectation it's an attorney-client communication, but I'm letting the government secretly record it, that privilege is not waived. I would get in trouble. I should get in trouble. It's the holder of the privilege that can waive it. So that was a clearly erroneous finding. In the alternative, the trial court said, well, if it isn't waived by consent, then it comes in under the statute evidentiary law, statute 19-1315. And that statute waives the privilege under circumstances where the communication concerns abuse of the child of either spouse. And so the issue then becomes before this court whether a fetus is a child for purposes of evidentiary law or statutory law specific to an evidentiary rule. And we submit that such an expansion is unwarranted and not what the legislator intended. I looked at Section 19.13.15 amendments, and I believe the last such amendment was in the 1970s, nothing after that. And why is that significant? Because the legislature added unborn child to other provisions in the South Dakota statute. Therefore, if they had wanted child to include fetuses for purposes of evidentiary law, then they would have so added unborn child, but they didn't. So child contemplates what is understood to be child, which is a known child of either spouse, alive and present. And that makes sense because, you know, in circumstances where a spouse is talking about a fetus that he believes is his child but isn't his child, and then you have to wait to find out if the fetus is the parent's child, and then it turns out it's not his child, then the communication would be privileged, whereas the fetus that was the spouse's child would not be. And that just is an anomaly that makes no sense under purposes of evidentiary law. And the legislature certainly can amend it if that's so their intent. However, Your Honors, even if this court finds that the privilege was waived, we submit that the secretly recorded phone call was inadmissible because it violated Alfredo's Sixth Amendment right to confrontation and Crawford. So its admission at trial was prejudicial error. One, the recorded statements.
Do you have case authority that phone calls fall under the Crawford ruling?
Yes.
Strikes me as unusual.
Well, I follow the analysis of Crawford, which states what is testimonial hearsay. Wife did not testify. That's not in dispute. Wife was unavailable. That's not in dispute. Was her statements testimonial hearsay? Was it testimonial? First, yes, it was testimonial because a reasonable person would have a reasonable expectation that her communication would be used for future prosecution. The lead detective in the case secretly recorded it, had a bug in her ear, was asking her to ask questions to Alfredo, so a reasonable person would expect that communication would be used for future purposes. Now, was it hearsay? Because that's the other way that it falls into Crawford. Yes, it was hearsay. These statements were not just going to, for truth of the matter asserted, Your Honors, they were actually went to the ultimate issue, because Alfredo never stated that he put anything in the girlfriend's drinks. He didn't say that. That statement came from the non-testifying wife in the recorded phone call. What she said was, "You said you put it in her drink." And so the ultimate issue, which was argued by the state in its closing, came from the non-testifying wife. And that's the most important statement from our perspective, but other statements that she made as contained in the appellate's brief were also testimonial hearsay. And they were not merely contextual statements as discussed in State v. Johnson. This is not a drug transaction kind of case where the unpresent speaker is just giving content to the defendant's statements. They were specific and went to the ultimate issue. They also permitted improper bolstering of Maggie Tove's testimony, because the wife was permitted without testifying to say, "Maggie Tove told me that you gave her black cohosh." And the rules prohibit bolstering of that kind, which occurred with the introduction of this tape. And so not only was it error, but it was prejudicial error, because even the state's lead detective said and admitted at trial that without this tape, the state didn't even have probable cause to arrest Alfredo. I would also like to talk a little bit about the error that occurred with qualifying the state's experts as experts. And I want to focus on Mr. Wold and Mr. Matheson, and I apologize, Justice Everson, for going into the facts, but part of that was for this discussion. The statute says that the admissibility of expert testimony is controlled by SD CL 1915-2, and the testimony that was presented was not based upon sufficient facts or data, or the testimony was the product of reliable principles and methods. And the trial court committed error in so finding. And the drastically different conclusions of the results show, when they use the same testing technique, that this data that was presented to the jury was not based on reliable principles or methods. Both Mr. Wold and Mr. Matheson testified that they had never tested Pulagon before, tested for it. From our perspective, they did not delineate anything that was sufficient to sustain a reliable principles and methods finding. And also, Your Honors, that goes to the argument of the sufficiency of the evidence with these conflicting results, with the murder weapons never being in this case, Penny Royale or Black Cohosh, with the liquid that the Pulagon was found in itself was never tested to determine whether Pulagon indeed was an ingredient of it, because, again, Pulagon can be found in mint. All of these things went to the sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor, and we ask that this court reverse Alfredo's conviction for attempted fetal homicide, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Ms. Cerska, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Lisa Gomez, while in a relationship with defendant, became pregnant with defendant's seventh child. When Lisa informed defendant of her pregnancy, defendant insisted on an abortion. Lisa refused and was shocked by his reaction. Defendant subsequently started bringing unsolicited fountain drinks, which he purchased to give to Lisa, which she described as some tasting bitter and gritty and some tasting minty. The first such fountain drink that he brought to Lisa, she thought it tasted suspicious and she threw it away. The second time defendant brought Lisa a fountain drink, she found it tasted bitter and gritty, observed a white powdery substance in the bottom of the cup. After Lisa finished the drink, defendant rinsed the cup out and threw it away. The third reported fountain drink defendant brought to Lisa while she was at work. Lisa described the drink as tasting terrible and smelling minty. Defendant attempted to shame Lisa into drinking the contaminated soft drink by appearing hurt or insulted when she did not want to drink it. After defendant left Lisa's workplace, she called the police, and the drink was collected for testing at the Rapid City Police Department. The police observed an oily substance in the drink and noted that the soda smelled minty and like gasoline. Defendant brought Lisa a fourth reported fountain drink when she was at work, and Lisa turned it over to the police without tasting the soda. Shortly after Lisa gave birth, Rapid City Police Department informed her that turpentine was found in one of the fountain drinks, and Pulagon, an oil extracted from the Penny Royale plant, was found in the other fountain drink. Penny Royale is described as a substance that induces abortion. The label on the Penny Royale plant warns against its use if pregnant or lactating and may be harmful or fatal if swallowed. About the same time defendant gave Lisa several altered drinks, defendant provided his sister-in-law with Cohosh. The sister-in-law was pregnant and near her delivery date and told defendant she wished she had some Cohosh to induce labor. Defendant offered his sister-in-law Cohosh and explained he had some because his girlfriend was pregnant and because they did not want the baby, he had been putting Cohosh in her drinks. The sister-in-law testified when she tried the Cohosh, it tasted bitter, like root water, and had no smell. Additionally, after the test results came back that Lisa's drinks were contaminated, the wife agreed to have a recorded phone conversation set up between defendant and his wife. The wife consented to the recorded phone call without defendant's knowledge. During the phone call, defendant made incriminating statements about providing his sister-in-law with a liquid to drink a few times a day and threatened his sister-in-law if she said anything about defendant to the police. Defendant also told his wife that he only gave Lisa, and I quote, two, and if she didn't drink it, I would spill him out. I would rinse it out. She never had anything. She had one drink that she took when she was at work, and that's it. The first issue is whether fetal homicide is a legal impossibility. Defendant argues that attempted fetal homicide cannot exist because the statute allows a person to be convicted for only intending bodily harm. But that are not the facts that were presented to the jury. And the facts are that the defendant intended to kill his child.
All right. The facts are one thing, but the instruction included the words or serious bodily injury.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that a problem?
No, Your Honor, because the statute is designed to address when serious bodily injury results in death. But that's not the facts of the case here. Here, defendant intended to cause the death of his unborn child. So, therefore, that statute applies for fetal homicide and for attempted fetal homicide. Defendant incorrectly analogizes this case with State v. Liarla, where this court held that Liarla could not be convicted of attempted second-degree murder when he did not have the specific intent to cause the death of the victims. This court held that you cannot intend an unintentional act by acting with a depraved mind, regardless of human life. In this case, Liarla does not apply because defendant intended to cause the death of his unborn child. He had the mens rea. Additionally, this is not a jurisdictional problem such as in State v. Liarla because attempted fetal homicide applies. The evidence overwhelmingly proved that defendant attempted to abort his child. There is no evidence to establish that defendant only intended serious bodily injury of his child. Defendant next argues fetal homicide mandates the actual death of the victim, and because defendant did not cause the death of his unborn child, he cannot be convicted of attempted fetal homicide. However, there is no authority to substantiate this claim. The attempted statute states that unless specifically saying otherwise, you can be convicted of an attempt. Defendant argues that other homicide statutes do not require the actual death of the victim. However, the definition of homicide is the killing of one human being, including an unborn child, by another. That language is clear. Additionally, the legislature intended to provide penalties for certain crimes against an unborn child. They amended several statutes to include unborn child, such as the definition of a person, homicide, first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, vehicular homicide, vehicular battery, criminal battery of an unborn child, and aggravated criminal battery of an unborn child. Defendant next argues that fetal assault is the more appropriate crime. However, defendant attempted to kill his baby. There is no evidence suggesting that he only attempted to injure the baby. Now, moving on to the issue of spousal privilege. The trial court properly found that spousal privilege did not operate to exclude the phone conversation between defendant and his wife. The trial court held there was no privilege where one spouse is charged with a crime against the person or property of a child of either.
First, before we get to that, you're going through the exceptions. What about the right first of a person to claim a spouse or a privilege on conversations with a spouse?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a spousal privilege. However, that privilege was statutorily waived because the context of the communication, there's no privilege in that context of the communication. Defendant does not own privilege in the conversation of intending to kill his unborn child. That the legislature took that privilege away because of the subject matter. And that exception is...
But the first part, it's the... Forget the waiver. Can the spouse, in this case the wife, can she waive the privilege, which is the husband's privilege?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the state submits that there was no privilege to be waived in the first place because of the exception that it was a crime against an unborn child of defendants. The trial court explained that the exception is to protect domestic life when someone commits a crime against the peace and dignity of the family. Defendant argues that the fetus does not carry the same rights as a human being because women have the legal right to abort the child. However, this argument ignores the language of the fetal homicide statute, which specifically states the crime of fetal homicide does not apply to an abortion when the pregnant woman consents. Here, Lisa refused to have an abortion. Defendant further argues his Sixth Amendment right was violated because the wife was not present to testify at trial. However, the recording was offered and admitted into evidence solely to consider defendant's own statements. The trial court provided a limiting instruction to the jury to consider only defendant's statements and not the wife's statements as facts. The statements by the wife were not testimonial and were not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Similarly, in State v. Running Bird, there was a recorded conversation between an officer and the defendant where the officer was not available to testify. The trial court properly provided a limiting instruction to only consider defendant's statements and not the officer's statements as direct testimony. The next issue is whether the trial court properly admitted the state's expert witness testimony. Defendant argues that the trial court erred in admitting the expert witness testimony because Professor Wold found turpentine in one of the sodas and Mr. Matheson found Polgon in the other can of soda. However, Professor Wold testified that he sent the soda to be tested by Mr. Matheson at the South Dakota Forensic Laboratory because that laboratory has the resources to do a more refined test. The South Dakota Forensic Laboratory has more sophisticated equipment. So it wasn't the lack of the ability of the experts. It was the lack of the equipment's ability to conduct the tests that needed to be done. All the evidence was presented to the jury, and the jury was there to determine the reliability of that testimony. The next issue is whether the evidence was sufficient to convict defendant of attempted fetal homicide. Defendant surreptitiously added the substances to Lisa's drinks with the specific intent to terminating their baby and failed in this attempt. Therefore, the trial court held this is sufficient evidence to support defendant's guilt of the crime of attempted fetal homicide. The state asks the court to rely on the briefs and inform on all issues. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lersko. Any final questions? All right. Thank you. Ms. Patterson, you have 10 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I will go through my list, notes I was taking in response to the state's arguments. First of all, the state said when the cup was sent for testing, that Pulagon was detected, and therefore they knew that it was extracted from Penny Royale. But that's not correct, because Pulagon in and of itself does not mean Penny Royale per se. Pulagon means mint. It comes from, it's a minty So it could be spearmint, it could be peppermint, it could be pennyroyal, it could be from toothpaste. It's unknown. So want to clarify that. The state said cohosh. There was a discussion with Maggie Tohabs versus cohosh. Again, trying to cloud over the issue. It is undisputed that black cohosh is distinct from blue cohosh, so it's not just cohosh. And Maggie Tove's testimony of black cohosh differed from her daughter's testimony of blue cohosh. And black cohosh has been known to be an anti-abortificiant. That is significant in a case of attempted fetal homicide. Now, I think the most important argument to discuss is the legal impossibility argument. And I think that we don't need to go into what the state actually argued, because what needs to be focused on, from my understanding of this court's instruction in its case law, is you look to what the jury instructions have stated, State v. Rosales. But the state did argue intent to commit serious bodily injury. So when the state says that there was no evidence presented of serious bodily injury, that is incorrect. I would note that in the state's rebuttal on page 511, the state says that even if the defendant was simply giving her Tic Tacs, dropping them in there, what was his intent? What did he think that would do? Did he think that would harm the baby? Did he think that would cause injury? That's an attempted crime. So the state in that argument is saying an intent to cause harm or injury is an attempted fetal homicide, and that's legally impossible. On page 512, the state again argues to the jury, he was giving her something. As I said, it's Tic Tacs as long as he was giving her something. When the intent to harm her or the child, that's what his intent was. So the state is arguing to the jury the very mens rea which makes attempted fetal homicide a legal impossibility. The state, in its argument that the language and caused the death, the plain language does not also render attempted fetal homicide a legal impossibility. The state said in its discussion of intent for when serious bodily injury, I took a note of when serious bodily injury results in the death, because I think the state's argument was, no, this instruction is not legally impossible because the intent for serious bodily is when serious bodily injury results in death. Well, if you follow that logic, then it goes to the second argument, which is a death had to have occurred for this crime to exist, which means you can't attempt a crime, a homicide crime, when the crime itself requires a death. So following the state's logic of that rationale, then and cause of death means just that. It's important to note, just briefly, homicide already, as we've discussed, the very definition is the killing of one human being by another, therefore and cause of death, again, becomes, means something plain and ordinary and is not unnecessary surplusage, which this court has says it does not interpret statutory language that way. We are not arguing that fetuses do not have the same right as a child. That has never been the argument. This really is not this case. This case is about the law and the plain meaning of the language in the statute. And if you're trying to expand evidentiary law, let's look at what the legislator intended when it wrote it, what it meant with child. And it didn't mean fetuses. I mean, that's really, it's that simple. Running Bird, just briefly, Running Bird really, the defense in that case was not arguing that the statements were hearsay. Instead, they were arguing that the statements went to opinion testimony of the defendant's truth, veracity, and that's impermissible. And that was the argument in that case. That's distinct from this case. Those were the notes I took, Your Honor. I know time is of a premium. So if there are no questions, I think I have nothing further to add.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you, Ms. Patterson. We are also on the internet, and it is stated there that we run on the hour, so we'll be in recess until 11 o'clock, and we'll have the third argument. Court's in recess.